I went for a gorgeous bike ride yesterday morning. Rode up to 360. I'm training for this ride called the Tour des Hügel, which is 106 miles, all the nastiest climbs. It's like 14,000 feet of climbing. So I'm trying to get out to find big hills to climb up. So there's this one hill, I don't know if anyone's climbed it, called Jester. Okay. So I'm climbing Jester. And if you've seen Ridgeway, which is around the corner, it's like Ridgeway, but like five times as long. Okay. So halfway up it, I run, no, what was it? 10% of my way up it, I run out of gears. And then I'm like, oh God, right? So I didn't make it. I had to traverse my way up. So by the time I get up there, my legs are screaming at me. My lungs are screaming at me. Everything hurts. But then when you turn around, you get this view of the city. And it was like 76 degrees, sunny, and there was this gentle breeze. And you know what's interesting? There was not one point at the top of that hill when I was enjoying myself. I thought of the beautiful sun. I thought of the spring-like weather. I thought of the scenery. I thought of the bike ride. Not at one point did I mention, wow, there's this gentle breeze. And there was. And I think this is the thing, that a gentle breeze is so beautiful and enjoyable, but it's kind of underrated and never really talked about, right? When was the last time you watched a weather forecast? You go, and today, there will be lots and lots of gentle breezes, right? It's usually something more like significant, something more in your face. Like there's going to be a sunshine. There's going to be like clouds hanging over. There's going to be hurricane like forced winds. And what Jesus is saying is there are people in this world who aren't really noticed, who don't really go out of their way to impress people. Sometimes they're kind of forgotten. Their voice isn't really even heard. And you know what? They're blessed. That's a great way for this world to be. See, usually when we meet people like that, this is what we do. We're like, you know, you're really talented. You need to put yourself out there, right? Make eye contact with people. Like find things they're interested in so that you can offer things you're interested in. Have your voice heard. And what Jesus is saying, you know, this world probably has enough like hurricane-like voices, winds that are trying to blow each other over. And maybe this world would be a great place if we just stopped impressing people, stopped trying to show them our resume, and just we are who we are, and we live as this gentle breeze. I think that'd be a beautiful, beautiful world to live in. I was trying to think of, who do I think of? What movie have I seen? What book have I read? When I think of someone who's meek and not really heard, I think Wes Anderson does a fantastic job of this in Fantastic Mr. Fox. You've got Ash the son, who's played by Jason Schwartzman, and he's living up to his dad, who has fantastic in his name, right? So you can't live up to that. His dad doesn't even notice him. And then, so as the movie develops, right, he's trying to earn his dad's attention. He's trying to impress his dad. And then to make things worse, his gracefully charismatic cousin, Christofferson, moves in with them. And so check out this clip.
Some hustle. Coach, we don't have whack bat where I'm from. What are the rules?
There's no whack bat on the other side of the river?
No, we mostly just run grass sprints or play acorns.
Huh. Well, it's real simple. Basically, there's three grabbers, three taggers, five twig runners, and the player at whack bat. The center tagger lights a pine cone, chucks it over the basket, and the whack batter tries to hit the cedar stick off the cross rock. Then the twig runners dash back and forth until the pine cone burns out and the umpire calls hot box. Finally, at the end, you count up however many score downs it adds up to and divide that by 9.
Got it.
Go in for Ash. Substitution! Ash, come out. You need a breather.
What? Come out? What? I still feel good, coach. Let me finish this eighth.
No. Come on. Step out. Step out. Let's go.
Am I getting better, coach?
Well, you're sure as cuss not getting any worse.
Really? I mean, you think I could end up being as good as my dad if I keep practicing?
Your dad? Your dad was probably the best whack bat player we ever had in this school. No, you don't want to have to compare yourself to that.
No, but I think I have some of the same raw natural talent, don't you?
You're improving. Let's put it like that. that's the first time this kid's ever swung a whack bat? He really is your father's nephew, isn't he?
Not by blood.
No?
He's from my mother's side.
Oh, yeah.
What's that stand for?
Huh? It's for Pep.
Pep. It's a K.
Come on now. Look alive. Attaboy.
We're going steady.
And I think what Jesus is saying then is that personality, the ones who are, I think we might call them wallflowers, the ones who don't go out of the way to have their voice heard, the ones who just kind of stand in the periphery, they're blessed. And maybe, you know, what we can ask for us then is, what do we do to impress people? Okay, and I think it looks different for everyone. Some people, it's what they do. Others, it's our degrees. Others of us, it's what we wear, who we hang out with, the type of music we listen to. Whatever that is that you wear on the external to impress people, if that were just pulled away and taken away, that mask that you use to be heard so that you'll be respected, if that were taken away, how would you feel about that? Would you be good to go? And Jesus is saying is, are those people that are in that moment and they don't have any of those externals and they're good to go, they're blessed. You know, I would say this. I think there's people in our community here who tend to be introverted, who are, you know, they don't really like large groups. They don't really like to fight to be heard. I'll just say that we need you as a community. And not only is it that, oh, you know, you guys are welcome. That's not the point. I think Jesus is saying is, we need to learn from you. And if our community could be that, if we could be this little countercultural community of meekness in Austin, it would be a beautiful thing. And I like this because Jesus starts doing his thing and people go, you're supposed to be the Messiah? I thought you were going to come like these gale force winds and blow us away. And he comes meek, gentle. Okay, so that's the first definition. Blessed are those who are kind of like a gentle breeze. Okay, the next one's like this. The other usage for meek is a tamed horse. Okay, that's also really graphic. There's the sense you have this animal that's beautiful, of raw energy potential, and then this process of taming it, right, utilizing that potential fully, is another usage of meekness. If you've ever like rescued an animal, our second dog is a rescue. Her name is Trixie. And she now is the best dog I've ever had. But when we first got her, I don't know what had happened to her. I don't know what her owners had done. But she was nervous. She was like powerful. And her thing was, whenever she was trapped in any confined space, she would try to break free. Okay. So when we first brought her home, she was home with the other dog. We let him roam free. We came home, and she had done a little damage. She had pulled a few cushions apart, possibly eaten half a door, maybe, right? When we put her in a fence, she would try to follow the circumference of the fence to find an exit. And then eventually, she just discovered that the fence is just aesthetic because she can jump over it in one bound. Right, I was telling my neighbor about this, about how, you know, she just likes to run free. We can't. There's nothing we can do. And I was explaining this to him. I had just closed the gate. She was clearly inside. I go, man, we don't know what to do to keep Trixie in there. And I look down. She's like outside of the fence, right at my feet. I was like, you're like a ninja. How did you do this? We find her sometimes. I'd be biking down the street. We can't find her. She's with like the Latino family down the street. Like mom, dad, and Trixie's just like hanging out with them. And she'd give me one of these, like, what's up? How's it going? But then over the process of loving her, and it's really because we loved her, we wanted to protect her, through love, through some, like, gentle communication of consequences, right? She's tamed. And there's this sense, this is what this word is used for someone with raw emotion, with raw passion, to be tampered into something a little more useful. I think a couple weeks ago on This American Life, there was an episode of this New Yorker. I don't know if you guys heard this. So he had gotten an iPhone with some of his friends. His was faulty. He went to the Apple store to get it fixed, had a bad experience, waited 4 hours, ends up leaving the Apple store, but he knocked off some things off of the Genius Bar, just like knocked it off, and then runs home, like upset. So he's trying to deal with his own frustrations. He's drinking, turns on Fight Club, and as he's watching Fight Club, Edward Norton has this rant that he thinks is beautiful. So he takes that rant and quotes it, pastes it in as his Facebook status. I think the rant had something to do with like automatic weapons and using them on perhaps the Apple store. So he just types that in as his status. Several hours later, he gets a knock on the door. Door opens. It's a SWAT team in Homeland Security. So months later, dozens of court cases later, the interviewer asks him, "So now that you've gone through all of this, what have you learned? Would you change at all?" This is his answer.
Since then, Joe's been to court more than half a dozen times over this. And from the sound of it, he hasn't been making things any easier for himself. By his own account, he's given one or two speeches about the Constitution and about how the terrorists have won. Not exactly one to dress for court, Joe recently got scolded for wearing Hawaiian shorts in the courtroom. Joe pointed to the guy next to him and said, "That guy's wearing sweatpants." This brings us to what might actually be the most remarkable thing about Joe's whole story, which is this. Most of us learn at some point in our lives that we shouldn't always say whatever impulsive thing we feel like saying. And if we didn't learn that lesson by getting in trouble in school or making someone cry, the day the cops showed up at our door with machine guns, or the day we had to stand up in court and face felony terrorism charges over a broken cell phone, those things would be a red light where we would stop and reevaluate. But has Joe reevaluated? Considered whether his life would be easier if he changed?
No. I don't think so. I mean, I haven't yet. I haven't. No. Yeah. I don't think I've ever gotten to a point where I'm like, "Oh man, let me change who I am." Nah, absolutely not. I don't know how, even if I wanted to like shut my mouth more often, I don't think I have the facilities to do so.
Why not?
I don't know. I can't. I don't want to. I don't want to. Because some of the people who love me for that. The people who hate me for that. So why am I going to worry about the people who hate me and not the people who love me?
All right. And so this word, it's almost like Jesus saying, "Blessed are those who are wise enough." Or maybe sometimes they don't even have a choice, but are in the process of being made meek. There's this verse in Numbers chapter 12, which is fascinating. So Moses marries outside of his race. His family is up in arms. Okay, they get into this huge argument. And then in Numbers 12, when they're talking about that, when they're talking about Moses like arguing with his family because he's married this woman outside of his race, there's like this one comment about Moses, and it says this: that Moses was the most meek man on the face of the earth. Like, out of all people on earth, he was the most meek. And I find that fascinating because when you first meet Moses, he is not meek, right? He's like a murderous prince. He gets thrust into rescuing his people from genocide because he kills a guy and then buries him. And then he negotiates with world superpowers. At some point, he's like on a mountain with God. They're trying to determine a moral code for a new people, a new society. They've spent days and hours. They've now etched this into stone. He comes down from the mountain, loses his temper, and then breaks it, right? So this guy's not meek. But then you read the rest of the narrative. He's got to deal with people's problems. People won't stop complaining. He makes some personal failures. He leads people into some failure. And then through that process, over decades, through suffering, through mistakes, it says now Moses was the most meek man on the face of the earth. I think that's astounding. Or you have Peter, right? When I think of Peter, I think of a guy who has zero filter, right? When Jesus goes, "You guys are going to betray me," he's like, "I will never betray you." And then he's like the first one to betray Jesus, right? When they're trying to arrest Jesus, he's out in arms. He's got his sword out. He's cutting off ears. There's blood dripping down people's faces. And then within hours, he's talking to this teenage girl, and she's like, hey, aren't you with this guy? And he's like, no, I had nothing to do with him. And then the rooster crows, and he lives 3 days of guilt and torment. And then his first interaction with Jesus, doesn't deal with the guilt, doesn't deal with the mistake, and just says, hey, man, do you love me? Do you really love me? And then through that process, he starts leading church communities. He starts writing to them. You know what? Be not just godly, not just faithful, not just righteous. Be completely, completely humble and meek. He says, if there's one attribute that people don't talk about that we should really value, he says, be meek. And for us, maybe, I don't know what that looks like. You know, maybe we're going through some hard things right now. Maybe there are lessons to be learned. Maybe we've made mistakes. You know, we've failed. And maybe it's a lot easier to avoid it, run from it, never talk about it. But maybe we run into whatever failure that was, accept what that feels like when, you know, people are maybe disappointed, and then learn the challenge and the difficulty of asking for forgiveness. And as we do that, as those things that we learn how to fail, we learn how to face suffering, we're slowly being made meek. Right? So those are the two definitions, right? When Jesus said, blessed are the meek, that's what people would have thought of, okay? A gentle breeze, a tamed horse, okay? And then he says this then. Okay, actually, I have two more quotes here on meekness that I think are pretty good. A.W. Tozer says this. He says, a meek man will attain a place of soul rest. He walks on in meekness, and he'll be happy to let God defend him. The old struggle to defend himself is over. He has found peace, which meekness brings. I like that. And then he says later, a meek man is not a human mouse afflicted with a sense of his own inferiority. He has simply accepted God's estimate of his own life. In himself, nothing. In God, everything. He knows well that the world will never see him as God sees him, and he's stopped caring. And there's freedom in that. Okay? So meekness. So then Jesus says, blessed are the meek. And then he says what? For they shall inherit the earth. Jesus is doing two things here. He's quoting Psalm 37, which David says, blessed are the meek, for they'll inherit the earth. And then he's also speaking to a culture of inheritance. And I don't know for you guys, for me, inheritance just isn't on my radar. It's just not a part of our culture and society that much. Maybe, you know, people around me don't have that much money. That's probably why. But in ancient cultures, in a lot of cultures still, inheritance is everything, right? So in the ancient world, if you were firstborn and you were male, you win, okay? Based on nothing else. You didn't accomplish anything. It has nothing to do with character. You just were born first and you're male. You get the inheritance, right? I don't really relate well to that. And I was trying to think why this was the case. And I think maybe because my parents got screwed over so badly by this idea of inheritance and firstborn males that they went out of their way to make sure we never experienced that. So my dad, he grew up in rural China. So it'd be like redneck China, okay, in the south. And in his culture, okay, it's still the case, firstborn male has everything. Grandpa's passed now, so he runs the show. Every decision is made through him, okay? So the second child was a daughter, and then at a young age, when she was like 4 or 5, she passed away. So grandma really, really wanted another daughter. So she kept going. She kept trying. And then 10 boys later, she still didn't get her daughter, okay? So my father was number 6. He wasn't number 1. So after you're number 1, you know, it's just not a big deal. And then add to that that he wasn't that girl to compensate for his older sister that's now gone. So by the time number 6 rolls around, he's born and basically no one cares about him. Like you raise yourself. Mom's too busy because she's got like 10 other boys. He left home when he was 12 and basically figured things out on his own. And he, you know, had the sense that I will never do that to my kids. On my mom's side of the family, there were 4 kids. The oldest one was a son, so he could call all the shots. So this is the order of kind of hierarchy in her family. So older son, my mom was number two, but she wasn't a son. So number three son was number two. And then the baby of the family, who's my aunt, and she was just cute. So she kind of like went up to number three. And then my mom was the second daughter, and kind of she just took the brunt of it, to the point where any of her brothers in front of my grandparents, they could not just verbally abuse her, they could physically abuse her. My first uncle kicked her to the point in front of my grandmother where she was urinating blood. That's the family she grew up in. And I think when she had kids, she was like, I will never, ever do that to my kids. They will all be loved. They all have value. But that's only a generation removed from me. And a lot of the world still operates like that. And in Jesus' culture, if you were male, if you were firstborn, you got all the inheritance. And then Jesus constantly goes out of his way and goes, you know what? The ones who have nothing, the ones who aren't that impressive in this world, they're the ones that are going to inherit the earth. They're the ones, when all is said and done, the blessing of goodness, of beauty, of my care, of my comfort. It's theirs now, and one day they'll inherit it. The prodigal son that he tells, right? That was basically a big part of that story. You have the first son who's home, who's dutiful, and then the younger son who's supposed to get nothing. He gets a small chunk, and he cashes it in. We don't know why. Maybe he's like, I'm not happy at home. I'm the younger son. I'm out of here. He now takes his inheritance and then defies his father, blows it, you know, on whatever he wants to do, and then comes to the point where he is in the meekest place on earth. He's eating pig food. I don't know if we connect that well to that either, because we kind of like pigs, or we at least like eating pigs, or some of us have had pet pigs, right? I like eating pig products with fat on it in a sandwich. It's really good, right? I don't know if we get the point of what Jesus is saying. Maybe a parallel could be rat food. So he finds himself, he's got nothing. He's so hungry, he's dipping into rat food and eating it. And then he, from this cocky, brash, arrogant younger son who hasn't made it on his own, has blown his wealth, comes crawling back, meek, humble. He's got nothing, tail between his legs. And in this story, the father sees him from a distance and comes running at him, embraces him, and he says, you know what? Cut the fattened calf. My son is lost. Now he's back. We're going to have a party, and all that I have is his. And time again, the ones that we think don't have, Jesus says, actually, they have more. Okay? So we come to this point, and I'm like, okay, those are great ideas, right? Like, it's a nice idea. People who are meek, who are shy, they're valued. Okay, that's nice. If we're suffering or we make mistakes, maybe we're being made meek, right? Okay, that's helpful. What do we do then? For a lot of us in this room, for some reason or another, we have skills that work well in 21st century modern day society. Right? Like for me, I am so happy and lucky to be born in an information age where communication, information, I like to read books, that's actually useful. If I was born in an agrarian society, I'd be so screwed, right? And it really has to be like, when were you born? Where are you born? So for us who just so happen to have skill sets, education, talents, that we're not that meek in society, how do we respond to that? And I would say this. I would say we have a task and a responsibility to defend the meek, to give a voice to the voiceless, to show how impressive people who never go out of their way to see their beauty, their gifts, to take whatever skill set, work, talent to go defend the meek. And I'll just close with this. Someone that I like a lot did this recently. Did you guys see Stephen Colbert when he went to Congress and he talked about migrant workers, right? So Stephen Colbert, and I think a lot of people still don't know, this is a character. And this is all political satire to try to reveal the flaw of politics. So they invite him because he volunteers to go work in one of these farms for a day. And they figure he's a celebrity. He can bring awareness to this issue. Let's bring Stephen Colbert in to talk about it. This is his opening statement.
And we will turn now to Mr. Colbert for his 5 minutes of testimony.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Colbert, and I am an American citizen. It is an honor and a privilege to be here today. Congresswoman Lofgren asked me to share my vast experience spending one day as a migrant farm worker. I am happy to use my celebrity to draw attention to this important, complicated issue, and I certainly hope that my star power can bump this hearing all the way up to C-SPAN 1. As we've heard this morning, America's farms are presently far too dependent on immigrant labor to pick our fruits and vegetables. Now, the obvious answer is for all of us to stop eating fruits and vegetables. And if you look at the recent obesity statistics, you'll see that many Americans have already started. Unfortunately, my gastroenterologist, Dr. Eichler, has informed me in no uncertain terms that they are a necessary source of roughage. As evidence, I would like to submit a video of my colonoscopy into the congressional record. Now, we all know there is a long tradition of great nations importing foreign workers to do their farm work. After all, it was the ancient Israelites who built the first food pyramids. But this is America. I don't want a tomato picked by a Mexican. I want it picked by an American, then sliced by a Guatemalan and served by a Venezuelan in a spa where a Chilean gives me a Brazilian. Because my great-grandfather did not travel across 4,000 miles of the Atlantic Ocean to see this country overrun by immigrants.
So it keeps going. You can watch the rest of it on your
own. He killed a man back in Ireland.
And you should. It's fantastic. Okay? So he goes on, and the politicians aren't laughing at all. Like, they're utterly confused. And then they ask him a series of questions, and then this one congresswoman asks him why he does it. And Stephen Colbert never breaks character, ever. But in his answer, he breaks character. And just the background, he's a Christian, and he explains why he chose to talk about this specific issue.
Mr. Colbert, you could work on so many issues. Why are you interested in this issue?
I like talking about people who don't have any power. And this seems like one of the least powerful people in the United States are migrant workers who come and do our work, but don't have any rights as a result. And yet we still invite them to come here and at the same time ask them to leave. And that's an interesting contradiction to me. And, you know, whatsoever you do for the least of my brothers, and these seem like the least of our brothers right now. A lot of people are least brothers right now because the economy is so hard. And I don't want to take anyone's hardship away from them or diminish anything like that. But migrant workers suffer and have no rights.
And I think that's a beautiful picture. I think our cities, this world, would be a more beautiful place if we stopped impressing, stopped becoming these hurricane forces of personalities and winds, and just we're okay in this gentle breeze. And then for those of us who have a chance, have an opportunity to go comb the world and defend the meek. And so I'll just close with this. There's a passage in Zephaniah that I think is just profoundly beautiful. And they're writing now to people who are in slavery, in oppression, in the Babylonian Empire. And then God writes to them and he talks to the meek. And then I'll close with a poem from Eugene Peterson. But this is what God says. And he's talking to those, they're working their hands to death. They're living short lives. They're under oppression. They're being killed. They're being oppressed. And then God, through Zephaniah, says this: on that day, you will not be put to shame for all the wrongdoings you have done to me, because I will remove from the city, so I'll take out from the city, those who rejoice in their pride. Never again will you be haughty on my holy hill. But I will leave within you the meek, the humble, who trusts in the name of the Lord. And then later he says, on that day, I will say to Jerusalem, do not fear. Do not let your hands hang limp. The Lord your God is with you. He is mighty to save. He will take great delight in you. He will quiet you with his love. He will rejoice over you with singing. The sorrows for the appointed feasts I will remove from you. They are a burden and a reproach to you. And then at that time, I will deal with all who oppress you. I will rescue the lame, gather those who have been scattered, and I will give them praise and honor. And at that time, I will gather you. At that time, I will bring you home. I will give you honor and praise among all peoples of the earth. I will restore your fortunes before your very eyes. Thus says the Lord. Eugene Peterson says this. He has this poem called The Lucky Meek. Moses, by turns raging and afraid, was meek under the thunderhead whiteness, the glorious opacity of a cloudy pillar. Each cloud is meek, buffeted by the winds. It changes shape, but never loses being. Not quite liquid, hardly solid, like me. Yielding to the gusting spirit, all becoming what ministering angels command, sign, promise, comfort. Vigorous in image and color, O colors of earth, pigments mixed with the sun, make hues that raise praises at dusk, at dawn collect storms, release rain, filter sun in arranged and weather measured shadows. Sun patches, a gentle breeze. Let's pray together.